in the students all confusion, already weeping through each other's arms. It's murder. New absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone. Murder. Shell shell like a bell and rung. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Nunn, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Nunn.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here.
And there are a number of questions about the competence and effectiveness of the prosecution in the Trayvon Martin case, given that Zimmerman, George Zimmerman, was acquitted on all charges. So it was a rout for the prosecution. Let's go through some of the apparent failures and try and figure out how and why they happened. These are the ones that I've listed, and you may have more. One, not having an African-American on the jury. Two, not allowing the issue of race to enter the trial. And three, inadequate jury instructions explaining all of the statutes in the Stand Your Ground law, particularly one that prohibits an armed citizen from being the aggressor. So let's begin with the first, if you will. Why not an African-American on the jury?
Well, he's being charged with second-degree murder and with manslaughter, which both are charges that are based on the quality of the defendant's behavior. That is it reckless or some form of extreme recklessness or negligent? And also, the defense he was raising was self-defense, which raises the question of whether or not it's reasonable or not. And both of those issues, that is, whether a person's unintentional conduct, that's what we call recklessness and negligence in criminal parlance, and the decision as to whether or not self-defense should be used, basically are cultural questions. Those are questions that are based on your worldview. Those are really, you know, questions of reasonableness, and reasonableness is always a
subjective
determination masquerading as an objective one. So because of that, who you have on the jury is really critical.
So why, I mean, in terms of jury selection, was it possible for the prosecution to insist on an African-American juror since they were all women and they were all white, weren't they?
No, it's not possible for them to insist upon one. But what it is possible to do is to manage your jury selection in a way so that you're paying attention to the ultimate outcome and to do everything in your power, as I'm sure George Zimmerman's attorneys did everything in their power to make sure that there were not African Americans on those juries. Now, there's a case called Batson, and then all the cases that come after it that have argued that you can't explicitly use race as a reason to exclude someone from a jury, and that applies to white jurors as well as African American and other minority jurors. But even so, you know, there are techniques that lawyers learn as they go through the process, and they can figure out how to kind of raise arguments and how to shape their questions in a way so that they can be attentive to that. So that's the one of the concerns that I was concerned at the outset when it turned out in a area that has as many African Americans as they do in Sanford that there were none on this jury.
And Kenneth Nunn, again, professor of law at the University of Florida and associate director of the Center for Children and Families in Gainesville, Florida. Let's turn to the second issue. Why did the judge not allow the issue of race to enter the trial? Surely the prosecution should have challenged that.
Well, they surely should have challenged that. I mean, I think that the judge's perspective and certainly the defense's perspective is that that would be inflammatory and it would direct direct the jury away from considering the evidence in the case. And that certainly is one way to look at race. That is, race is, or to talk about racial divisions and racial issues and racial perspectives is always something that's essentially emotional and is not practical, doesn't focus on facts. And that's one view of it, and I'd have to say it's probably the dominant political view today. But if you were to look at the literature of people who actually study race, whether we're talking about sociologists or, you know, law professors such as myself, there's another view of race which talks about the degree that it permeates the culture in which we live, and it's a part of our environment and our reality, and you can't get away from it so easily by simply ignoring it. And so discussion of that character of race, talk about unconscious racism or implicit racism, and whether or not this was a case where a black man was being profiled because he fit some sort of stereotype, I think was a legitimate issue for the jury to be aware of and to be talking about when they were evaluating the reasonableness of George Zimmerman's behavior.
Well, it's hard for me not to see race as being absolutely inherent in this whole situation. Not to suggest that Zimmerman was a racist, but he seemed to think that there were these people, outsiders, whatever you want to call them, that were affecting the security of this community. I mean, he had literally volunteered to go out there and be a kind of vigilante, looking for crime where it didn't necessarily exist and looking for people that he considered to be perpetrators of crime. So were they able to establish his worldview, Zimmerman's worldview, that who was responsible for crime? And There he was, you know, a self-appointed crime fighter.
Well, a lot of people think that in order to be a racist, or that, you know, in order to do something that has racist connotations, you have to be kind of an old-fashioned Southern sheriff or Klansman or something of that nature. And I think that's the wrong perspective to have. And from that perspective, people get offended when you bring race into the discussion to talk about why people are performing the way that they're performing. Well, why do you have to play the race card is the retort that you hear a lot. But it isn't necessarily true that every time you are talking about the impact of race that you're saying that someone has a, you know, malicious intent of some sort. It may simply be something that's unconscious, that they're not aware of, that they were, as we were discussing, raised in a particular cultural environment. And so to them, they don't even see the racist content of what their behavior is. Now, it's also true that we know from studies of jurors and when, you know, how they vote on cases, that it's quite helpful in circumstances where there is a racial dimension to the facts to have a person of color on the jury to help interpret that possibility for the other jurors who don't even think about those things. They just don't think about them.
Well, but surely, Kenneth Nunn, that would have been helpful to have an African American on the jury to explain the key witness who most analysts and, frankly, most of what you saw on television, you couldn't avoid this trial. I mean, it was absolutely ubiquitous everywhere on television. The takeaway was that Janelle was a terrible witness, etc. But you know, surely she needed explaining, didn't she?
You're talking about Rachel Gentile. She did, because there probably weren't many people from the suburban middle class background that my guess is most of these jurors come from, who have run into young girls or boys like Rachel Gentile, who understand the language, who understand the use of slang, who understand the way that they would want to, you know, be not be in the public limelight, you know, and all of that. I mean, she, you know, I've you know, worked in and lived in inner city communities all my life, and I can certainly tell you that she was not unique. She was not some sort of strange, you know, person who just, you know, dropped down from the sky. But she, you know, she was sort of a regular, you know, ordinary, salt of the earth young lady from that community whose sincerity could really be established if you were familiar with her background and what she was talking about. So I think that either having a person on the jury, certainly who was familiar with that, either through their background experience or from their upbringing, would have been helpful.
And just let's go then to the third point, and that is the inadequate jury instructions explaining all of the statutes in the Stand Your Ground law, particularly one that prohibits an armed citizen from being the aggressor. So explain that part of the statute, and for the life of me, I don't understand why that was not included in the jury instructions.
Right. Well, let's walk that through. We were talking earlier about how homicide has these different grades, and for each of them, you have to decide what was the character of the person's behavior, because you know you always have what was their mental state. Basically, you always have the fact that there is a person who's been killed, and so that's constant with all homicide. But the reason why they were killed makes a difference in how we grade it. And then after that, you will always see routinely see self-defense offered as a defense in the case. And in order to claim self-defense, you have to show that it was reasonable for you to use deadly force on that occasion against that person. So so in that regard, Florida law is pretty standard. But there's another principle, and that is, if you have the opportunity to leave a violent conflict without getting hurt yourself, and the only other way you could end the conflict was to kill somebody, should you be required to leave the conflict and not result in action that will result in somebody's death? And so what that rule is called the retreat rule. It's like you should retreat before you kill somebody. And ordinarily, the majority of American states say, yes, you have to retreat before you use deadly force. Florida and sort of a minority of states say, no, you don't, that you can stand your ground, and even if it was perfectly safe for you to leave, to go back in your car or back in your house, you don't have to. And so they were instructed on the stand your ground aspect, that is, you have a right to use deadly force and not retreat first. But there are facts in this case that would say that that rule would not apply, because that rule only applies when the defendant was not the person who precipitated the conflict in the first place. So I thought that the prosecution should have insisted on that part of the instructions being read to the jury, and they weren't.
So, Kenneth Nunn, professor of law at the University of Florida and associate director of the Center for Children and Families, do you have children?
I do.
I'm thinking of what the president said at the beginning of this Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman incident some time back when it happened, that Trayvon Martin could have been his son. I'm paraphrasing what the president said.
Right.
That still hangs over us, doesn't it? I mean, and hangs over you as an African-American parent.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, I think the problem with the verdict in this case is it seems to suggest that young African-American males have to have a heightened sensitivity to the way that they impact other people, whether it is their fault or not, and that whenever anyone may be frightened by them or unduly suspicious of them, that their lives are at risk. And you know, as an African American parent, I don't have any sons, but I do have daughters, But I do know that's something that African-American parents tell their children anyway. But one certainly would hope that you didn't have to live in a country or in a world where that was the nature of reality that you faced.
And also, I thought that adding insult to injury was all that speculation that African-American communities would explode in rage. So that was some kind of a reflex.
Well, you know, it's when you start talking about the way that race played in the case, the first issue is, well, blacks are dangerous, they're violent, you know, they're wearing hoodies, they're walking through our neighborhood, they must be about to commit a crime. And what else do we know about blacks? We know, you know, another motif I hear a lot in connection with this case is how emotional blacks are. Well, that was an emotional outburst from Rachel John Teal, or the people who were protesting were working on emotion. So there's all this issue about emotion and violence and all of that. So one would expect, if you believe that, that you would think, oh, the black community is going to blow up because of the verdict in the case. That didn't happen.
Well, Kenneth Nunn, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Ian. Best wishes.
Same to you. Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Nunn, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center for Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Another headline written down in America.